Hello and welcome to Sci-Fi.
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 Yep, sci-fi, sci-fi, sci-fi. Podcast where we're just going to go with this.
We got the giggles. At least some of us are having fun.
Absolutely. Yeah. So today we're going to be talking about Strange the Dreamer by Lainey Taylor. This was narrated by Steve West. From the back of the book. And oh boy, this is a long one, folks. Buckle in.
Enjoy.
Click.
The dream chooses the dreamer, not the other way around. And Laszlo Strange, war orphan and junior librarian, has always feared that his dream chose poorly. Since he was 5 years old, he's been obsessed with the mythic lost city of Weep, but it would take someone bolder than he to cross half the world in search of it. Then a stunning opportunity presents itself in the person of a hero called the Godslayer and a band of legendary warriors, and he has to seize his chance or lose his dream forever. What happened in Weep 200 years ago to cut it off from the rest of the world? What exactly did the Godslayer slay that went by the name of God? And what is the mysterious problem he now seeks help in solving? I don't know. Why are you asking me? The answers await in Weep, but so do more mysteries, including the blue-skinned goddess who appears in Laszlo's dreams. How did he dream her before he knew she existed? And if all the gods are dead, why does she seem so real? In this sweeping and breathtaking new novel by National Book Award finalist Lainey Taylor, author of the New York Times best-selling Daughter of Smoke and Bone trilogy, the shadow of the past is as real as the ghosts who haunt the citadel of murdered gods. Fall into a mythical world of dread and wonder, moths and nightmares, love and carnage. Welcome to Weep. Okay.
That's a hell of a back of a book.
That is one hell of the back of a book. And I can't really say it spoils a whole lot. Mostly it just asks you what happened.
Citadel of Murdered Gods. That does sound like a module name or something.
You know, and I've read the book. I don't think I know the answers to some of these questions.
Maybe it's all in part two. And that's thunder.
Oh, yes. Well, we've angered the gods, you see.
Look, Thor's swinging his hammer.
I'm going to leave that one alone. All right. So what did everybody think?
I really enjoyed it. I'm not sure I understand it.
Right.
I understand parts of it, but I really enjoyed it.
Yeah. Kevin?
I mostly enjoyed it.
Okay.
I was thrown off guard when it randomly got to the Y romance part. I wasn't expecting towards the end.
Yeah. This is a young adult fantasy romance. It's showing up on a lot of lists of the best science fiction and fantasy book, and that's why I chose it. And I don't regret choosing it, but I had a better experience in some ways than you two did because I was running a bit late, so I was already privy to your comments about, what was it, Barry, that you said?
I think I sent out a image of, what is it, a young Fred Savage asking, is this a kissing book?
And yes it is.
And not that much, it's just there's a chapter dedicated towards the end.
Right. Also, sort of anti-spoiler, this is a duology, and you know, it's a first of a series type of thing. Do not expect a complete conclusion. I expected one and was disappointed at the end. So
yeah, I had no idea that this was more than one book, and I was left at the end going, well, that wasn't wholly satisfying.
Yeah, exactly. So we are judging the first half of a series at best here. But I found the imagery to be really vivid, and I really liked the main characters, which is, in romance books, usually I hate at least one of the characters, and in this one, I at least liked both of them.
Right. I was not fond of the Minya character, who is not one of the main ones, but one of the main secondary characters.
You're not supposed to like her.
Yes. Well, that's the point, but I guess they did a reasonable job of making me dislike her.
Right.
There are a lot of players in this book.
Yeah. There's a lot of characters.
Way more than I was expecting.
We write up character sheets so we can then utterly fail to consult them.
Or at least confuse them and
yeah, exactly.
Make us sound like idiots.
Exactly. But not hard. It would be even worse if we didn't have the character sheets. And this one's about half of a page here and I didn't even really get started.
Yeah, you left a few off. Or we left a few off.
I mean, yes.
I did make an attempt to rearrange them into some sort of more logical order, but it didn't work.
We are currently reviewing our own notes. Yay.
Hey, it's the newest thing in podcasts.
Exactly.
It's a metacast.
If you'd like to, you know, pay us for this privilege via Patreon or something like that, you can, we could share our notes with you.
Woo. Yep. Yeah, so the prose I thought got a little bit purple towards the end.
How do you define purple?
Yeah, can you explain what you mean by purple?
Rather than saying what was happening in ordinary speech, there was a lot of poetic allusion to things rather than just saying, okay, I nearly said something that really would give too many things away.
I think I know what you mean, but that may be true, but it wasn't bad. I mean, the one thing I really liked about the book actually was that it felt original.
Yes.
It wasn't like, oh, look, it's a go to this place and bring something or find something. I mean, that's kind of what it is, but it didn't feel like that.
Right. This largely takes place in dreams, and I'm kind of surprised that you don't see that setting more often in fantasy novels, given that that's what fantasy novels kind of are.
Right. I mean, I was kind of thinking, I know I've seen something very specific, and I still can't think of what I was thinking, but then I realized, oh, H.P. Lovecraft does have a whole section of basically dream fiction, although it's more abstract.
Yeah, I think H.P. Lovecraft would really be repulsed by this book. But mostly, I don't think he likes kissing books very much.
I think you're starting to see a lot more of this, you know, dream factor in science fiction books now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Or at least maybe in television, for sure.
1970s, like sci television.
Yeah, I was comparing it to, I think, a 70s or 80s movie called Dreamscape, which features a lot of shared dreams. Didn't really take as much advantage of it as they did here. So, yeah, I thought it was a lot of fun, very vivid. I have to give it the accolade of a few times I just sort of wanted to go back and re-enter the world of it because it's so vivid. It reminded me a lot of Zelda, but I'm playing a lot of Zelda. Yes. Everything reminds me of Zelda right now.
Probably. That's,
yeah, I felt a lot of the language is very poetic, and the word choices were helped cement what was, you know, happening in the book in my mind.
Mm-hmm. Also, if you like libraries, then you might like this book too.
Oh, yeah. There's a lot of cool library stuff. So, yeah, I think that's about as far as we can go without spoiling things. So before we ruin your tongues for all future tastes, it's time for us to move into our spoilers section. We shall return, for we are sci-fi.
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 All right, and welcome back. So this is a book that follows Laszlo, who is, for most of the book, a very timid librarian. And towards the end, we get the sudden realization that he's a god. Question is, first of all, when did we start to think that he was actually one of the blue gods in the sky?
Well, I think even during the first part of the book, when he's in the library as a child, you know, the fact they describe that he's an orphan, and, you know, they give him the last name Strange, which is sort of the last name they give to all orphans. And then they essentially give him a first name of Laszlo, right? And we haven't been exposed to the blue gods or anything like that yet. Even, I think, through the first third of the book, you don't even really know about them.
Right.
I got the sense that was, you know, he was more than what he would appear to be, being such a non-outlandish character, which I kind of actually appreciated, you know, in a landscape of books where every character is, you know, overpowered, superpowered, it's got some sort of mojo. Right.
And that was the thing that I didn't really like. Now, granted, this is the middle of the book, so it only sort of seems to me like at the end he's suddenly a god.
Yeah, it comes on very suddenly at the end.
Right, but this is really the middle of the book. I mean, it's a two-book series, so I can't really judge it that way. But I was a little bit disappointed that they made him actually be secretly a god. I kind of liked the character of Laszlo, the librarian who had a really good imagination and kind of had the power of dreams. I thought that was his whole deal. So right. I didn't see it coming at all.
Like, you know, weird power to consume books. I mean, not physically, but, you know, having, you know, flip through them, he kind of gets the idea of what's going on there. And he knows, like, the perfect book as,
yeah, you know, he had librarian superpowers.
Right. He knew the card catalog inside and out.
Mm-hmm.
What is it? The Dion Nero, right, basically takes advantage of his kindness, because
right.
Laszlo gives him the book of, what is it, the Breakfast of Miracles or something?
Miracles for Breakfast.
Miracles for Breakfast. is there really a difference there?
and
And then abuses him for it.
I thought it was sort of interesting because Laszlo was a character that was kind for its own sake, which is remarkably unusual, even in heroes of a book.
That's true.
Yeah.
Even because he didn't expect anything other than the abuse that he got. He knew that he wasn't going to get any thanks for helping Thion Nero. He just did it because that was what was needed.
Right. And basically, he helps him figure out what the missing ingredient is for his transmutation of lead into gold, which is Azoth, which I guess everybody in this universe has two circulatory systems.
Yeah, that was sort of subtle. They're all Time Lords, in other words. They've all got two hearts, and I got the impression that one of them was actually literally pumping spirit around the body.
Yeah. And I went back and listened and checked, and yeah, there's two circulatory systems that are in parallel, and one is some kind of spirit that they don't understand, and one is blood. And at first I was like, is this like, you know,
the Azoth?
Yeah, yeah. And well, that's, I guess he uses it to make that, but you know, because I was thinking, is this just some, you know, are they making some kind of flowery language about your spirit pumps in your body somehow? Right. It's like, no, this is,
it's
like
physical, yeah.
And so yeah, it's like reminding me, I mean, I guess it's kind of a trope of like, you know, almost like us, but not quite. You know, it's right. Like one way to sort of differentiate it and so like it kind of reminded me of his Dark Materials series where, you know, you're essentially your soul is like a physical animal that you talk to and kind of has to be near you and stuff like that. And
right. It's a way of representing dualism very concretely inside a book. And I really liked it because, you know, you're in a fantasy novel. Why not, you know, do something like that?
Right.
You know, why posit this sort of external magical thing when you can just give people two circulatory systems? No, I thought that was great. And I just loved how consistent it was. And they never really made that big a deal about it. They never said, oh, and in this universe, there are two circulatory systems. They talked about his hearts for a little while. And
right.
They did, you know, go a bit into the anatomy, but they never made that huge a deal out of it that I remember.
Yeah, they kind of said, well, they made kind of the analogy where it's like, if your spirit heart just stopped pumping, you wouldn't die. You just were kind of lifeless and like kind of nothing that really interested you. So it's just like working for the rest of your life. And then you're like, whatever.
You become a zombie. Yeah.
Or that could happen. I don't know.
It would almost be like living in this universe. Yes. Yeah. Okay. So yeah, I think it seemed to me like, you know, Laszlo changed quite a bit at the end, and given that it's the middle of a two-book set, then I'm more inclined to forgive it. But I liked the character as he was in the beginning. And I'm sure right. that as things settle, maybe we'll get a little bit more of his original version. But I liked just the idea of, you know, of the librarian superpowers. Just that that was enough.
Well, right. It's like he's just smart and he knows a lot of stuff. And his perk is that he, you know, knows a lot about this ancient language and stuff, so it comes in handy when he goes there. And
right. And I mean, granted, I'm biased as somebody who collects facts like a magpie.
Yes.
Well, he also sees, when he dreams, he sees Weep as a very different place than it really is, right? It's much more brightly colored and, you know, there's flags and streamers and
right.
and whatnot, whereas in reality, it's a very, you know, dark, dreary place, right?
Mm-hmm.
And well, it is now. I think he imagined this like glorious place, and maybe it once was like that.
Or he sees it as it stories. Should be. Maybe he sees it as it should be, or
how it was before.
Or how it was, one or the other, right?
Various cataclysms happened, yes. Well, because it's literally in shadow. There's a giant statue floating over the thing.
Right.
Right. That's the big reveal, is that, you know, they basically, you know, these gods came there a couple hundred years ago or whenever it was.
Just like the giant floating bird in Zelda, sorry.
Yes. And they basically subjugate the people and abuse them. And, you know, it's like Prima Nocte forever, you know, or whatever. It's just like, and
okay, I'm going to add that to the band name list.
And so, you know, they pretty vividly explain, you know, why the people might rise up and be not happy with the gods, right?
Whenever in a fantasy novel they talk about, oh, these people came from the other side of the sky, then the science fiction part of my brain sort of wakes up and just like, oh, these must be travelers from our universe. And just like, no, no, no. It's just another fantasy thing. Calm down.
Yes, from another universe, and they come down. But sometimes, yeah, you do think of it that way where it's like, and then I did think about that a little bit where it's like they're just, you know, high technology people that came from somewhere, and
it's the blue avatar people finally come back for the revenge.
Exactly. They're just subjugating the populace. And although they,
Carl, how's it feel?
For a while I was thinking, well, because they said, well, what happened to all the offspring, right? You know, and they had kind of just disappeared, and it seems like they were, you know, like it turns out probably Laszlo was just one of the ones they dropped off somewhere. And you're like, so was there some, are they ever going to explore that kind of, you know, hidden agenda or whatever they're doing? Are they kind of breeding gods into the populace or something? Or is it just sort of like, you know, well, how do we get rid of this, you know, side effect of,
it's like having
abusing bastard, the populace? I don't know. Just dump them somewhere, like give them to orphanage.
Is it like having bastard gods? You're like, whoops.
I mean, I got maybe the impression that the gods were not fertile just with themselves, that in order to actually have god children, they had to rape the populace basically.
But the thing was, then they didn't actually directly say, like, well, you know, right, was there a secondary reason? Were they trying to do something with the children, you know, or just like, oh, we mm-hmm. don't want these things. So,
right. Exactly.
You know, so for a while I thought, oh, this maybe was part of a larger plot line. But you know, that never came up. So,
well, could still be,
it may or may not come up.
I actually wouldn't put it past the gods here. Just, they did it because they're evil.
I mean, they don't seem...
Some of them seem very, very evil, yeah.
Well, you know, when you're the goddess of despair, you've got certain things you kind of have to do to maintain God's street cred.
It's like, I have to. I'm sorry, you know.
Yeah. It's not that I want to curb stomp you, but I have to because, well...
Exactly. You know. So one of the things that I really liked was we have the Muse of Nightmares who suddenly discovers that there's somebody who can see her in dreams. Yes, Sarai
actually looks back.
Yeah, exactly. Sarai and Laszlo then use dreams to their fullest extent. Well, not to their fullest extent quite yet. They were getting there.
We don't know for sure. Maybe
it was a long windup.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's quite a long windup.
I was sort of surprised that I couldn't remember another fantasy novel that had used shared dreams in quite this way. That, I mean, that they're actually dreams, not sort of shared visions or something like that.
Right. Or like they go to another world that you enter through dreams or something. Or
right.
And you're right. That seems like that would be incredibly common, but I can't think of, you know, probably someone saying, yes, of course, all these other books. Right. Have you heard of that?
My entire library.
Yeah, some variant of Laszlo. I can't think of any other fantasy books, but I can think of some sci-fi stuff, but it's not quite the same.
Yeah, let's see. There was something called the Dueling Machine that was sort of, I forget, I think that was Ben Bova. It sort of linked up two people's brains and so that they could fight each other without actually hurting each other. And then some people got to use that for other purposes.
I think one of Kevin's favorite Star Trek The Next Generation episodes.
You mean with Troy?
Yeah.
What, the one eye circling?
Or? Exactly.
Yeah, actually, I did think of that too, and we were trying to think of other examples of, okay, there's that one, and then there's the cake one.
I mean, and there's
holodeck facilitated.
There's various like Freddy Krueger stuff, but that was always with sort of this tinge of pain or negativity. Whereas this was the first time that I had seen just dreams used for fun,
like dream holodeck.
Yeah, exactly. And just sticking with it, didn't just say, oh, well, they dreamed together and it was so awesome. They actually like stay there and describe the dream.
Well, Geordi's dream with Leah Brahms didn't really go so well.
Started okay. Theoretically, they wound up married at the end, right? I'm getting mixed up.
I think there were too many different timelines. So this whole thing of the Godspawn, right, where kind of the one of the major other players was the offspring of the gods when Errol Fain goes in and he's, you know, he's sort of one of the abused and by one of the evil goddesses, and he just sort of snaps. Uh-huh. You know, basically she tortures him by implanting this perfect love for her in his brain, but he also hates her at the same time, so he kind of goes crazy and finally just sort of like
massacres
everyone, including all the children.
Yeah.
And it is interesting because they're able to sort of present him as a very complex character.
Yeah, he wasn't, you know, he didn't like the fact that he had to do it, and it still, you know, gives him nightmares. And but then, of course, you know, Laszlo's girlfriend is the god spawn, you know, of the four or five that survived.
Right. And is his daughter.
Yes, is his daughter. She's the one with the dream powers. I mean, I thought that was at least an interesting image where she vomits up these like butterflies or moths or something.
Yeah, I thought that was really good.
And then like, you know, her that's, you know, she can't speak while her, you know, remote voice moths or whatever go out and like, you know, when they touch someone, she could enter their dreams kind of all in parallel. So it's kind of a cool power, I guess. Like, you know,
yeah, my brain is just like, how is she handling that kind of processing?
I know.
Yeah.
She has a lot of cores.
too much input. And well, she kind of describes it as sort of like this 360 degree view of like everything that's going on in everybody's dreams in the city. Right.
Right. Yeah. And usually she could handle it. And,
yeah.
Unless she's like really trying to concentrate on something or she gets startled. But, so yeah, I thought that was an interesting thing. And it's interesting that like, you know, every Godspawn gets their own sort of power. It's like some RPG thing where it's like, okay, let's roll up what your superpower is. Like,
and only one could be, you know, only each one could be used once. So right. Once it's taken, it's taken.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah. And then part of the setting, you know, which is also very striking, is this floating, it was like a citadel. I forget what they call it.
They describe it as a citadel, but it sounds like it's shaped like an angel, a seraphim, right?
Yeah, it's like a giant seraphim. That's everything's in shadow, which is kind of what's caused them to come and try to get people to deal with this. And of course, when they were describing it as this floating citadel, I was thinking, hey, it's like Castle Amber or something, like, you know, the old D&D module.
Yes.
Like I said, I already was relating it to Zelda Breath of the Wild.
Yes.
Does it have a Castle Amber too?
It doesn't have a Castle Amber. It's got a giant floating bird. So without really thinking about it, I put them in a giant floating bird just because.
That makes sense. there were wings in it.
That's how it was my dream. But yeah, I figured that it was, you know, it took me a second to realize that, oh, okay, they're in a statue. And, you know, so they actually like flew up to the hand at one point.
Yeah, until they used the word seraphim, I actually had kind of considered it to be sort of like a, you know, a giant obelisk with a sphinx, you know, with the wings outspread at the top or something.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I will say that, you know, so at the end, right, it kind of, like you said, it very quickly
escalates,
yes. I was going to say devolves, but that didn't seem like the right word. It quickly escalates into like, oh, crap, stuff happens. You know, basically they hint at the explosionist gets a little drunk and pissed that no one's going to use his, you know, his magic power.
Which is one of my next game characters. He's going to be an explosionist.
So he's just like, okay, I'm just going to take my whole pack of stuff and just blow up one of these things. And it doesn't blow it up, but it, you know, basically digs a big hole underneath it and kind of, you know, puts
from
it off kilter.
From the character sheet, his name is Drave.
Drave.
Now, does he actually appear before that somewhere?
Oh, yeah. I mean, he was there from the beginning. He was part of the party.
Okay.
He actually was... He hung around with Thion Nero a lot. He was sort of
one of those buddies.
Yeah. He didn't exactly specify that for some variant of those, but.
and right. So, you know, that's when it quickly escalates and everyone's like, oh crap, the statue's going to fall over because they thought it was like a balloon and this was like keeping it down. But in fact, these were like some kind of magnetic hole, you know, floaters or something like that. And
right. There's like multiple anchors that are
right.
Seem to be holding it in place.
And so one of the anchors like, you know, gets kind of askew and is going to fall into this big pit. And it's like, oh, crap, the thing is going to just fall and crush everyone in the city. And
well, that's only one part of the city. Right.
Right.
I mean, everybody run.
Yeah. So, you know, Laszlo conveniently just.
Oh, yes. And
comes into his own.
Yeah, exactly. That just happens just at the right time when he's figured out that, oh, by the way, I'm a god. Hey, looks like I've been a god this whole time.
Right. I mean, they hint at it slightly where he's in the dream and the magic fog that turns you into something and he becomes a god in there and his girlfriend turns into a person.
But at the same time, you know, you assume maybe there's something special about him, but it could have been just, oh, he really wanted to be a god.
Right, because I was also thinking that too, where I kind of like you, I didn't want him to be a god. Right. And I thought maybe there's, you know, some of the stuff was hidden in plain sight, like, oh, he, you know, he touches the obelisk things, whatever, the stand things, and like, and, you know, he gets something on his hand, and it discolors his hand, and like, and he's like talking to the alchemist, and he's like, well, nothing interacts with this at all. You know, nothing changes it, and no chemicals interact with it. And he doesn't bother to mention, oh, well, it turns my hands a weird color.
Yeah, they call it the Mesarthium, which is the metal that the anchors and everything seems to be made out of, that, you know, the gods come from. Yeah, like you said, at one point he touches it and it kind of like rubs off on his hand.
Right.
You know, it's supposed to be, you know, until this point it was completely non-reactive to
right.
And so everything that they had, including, you know, cutting and acids and
right. And yeah. So it's kind of like foreshadowing, but you're like, you know, you're like, okay, that was one example, you know, and generally he's pretty smart, but he like doesn't think to mention, or maybe he did and they kind of dismissed him. I forget.
Maybe Laszlo's a universal oxidant.
Exactly.
Could be.
But I will give it credit in for at least making it not sort of a really sappy expected ending, which is the way I expect it to go. You know, his kind of a, oh really, that had to happen, but you know, his girlfriend is the one who falls out into her death and dies. You know. So it's a very goth
ending. As the anchor collapses, right, she falls out the window
right
at the top of the citadel and falls onto this, you know, basically a giant spear at the top of a gate.
And I
which I think is actually the opening of the book as well.
Which I completely, you know, just went whoosh over my head. My brain was still sort of clicking into the language and so forth. And so I completely missed that part until we got to the end. And then I went back to the beginning. It's just like, oh, they said exactly that this was going to happen.
Right. They said it. And that's where all I remembered was some blue thing fell out of the sky. And so I was thinking, were they talking about Laszlo falling blue out of the sky? And then he like changed after when they found him or something? Like, no, it was just this part at the end of the book.
Right. And for some reason, my brain was just in denial. I will credit the book with making me like the characters enough that I didn't want it to be her. And so I'm just like, oh, it must have been like, yeah, it was Sparrow, the nice one, or, you know.
I thought they were just going to make it an easy ending. Minya was going to fall, and then only the happy and nice ones were left.
Right.
And so they didn't do that.
Granted, we didn't realize it was a two-book series.
Right. And, you know, we know that Minya can, you know, basically grasp souls as they're dying and kind of reanimate them. So I'm thinking, okay,
control them.
We know this is going to happen at this point, right? We know that she's going to grab her and save her or something.
For some reason, the most obvious next steps just kept on not occurring to me, or occurring to me and me thinking, oh, but they're not going to do that.
Of course not.
I really like the Minya character descriptions. You know, she was a very compelling, I don't want to call her a antagonist, but, you know, a very compelling character. You know, she's sort of perpetually stuck at the age of six.
Right.
I'd call her an antagonist. I mean, she's certainly the narrative action against Sarai.
Yeah. I think she's just doing her thing, right? I mean,
well, sure. I mean, she's developed well enough that you can sympathize with her a bit.
Yeah.
Right.
But, you know, the fact that she, you know, collects all these ghosts and controls them, it was a very, you know, well-developed character, I thought.
Right.
You know, and that she stores them basically at they called it the heart of the citadel, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the door, no one can open the door, you know, any bigger than like what she could squeeze past.
Right.
And she had managed to stay eternally small somehow.
Right. I don't remember that mechanism, but I definitely remember.
I don't think they ever explained it.
Okay. It's in the second book.
I think it was just, at one point they said, well, you know, through force of will, maybe she kind of, you know, kept her anger alive the whole time. And you're right. She's not very likable in general, but they fleshed her out enough to kind of give a reason why it's like, you know, she's the only witness to this massacre, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so she just wants revenge and she's stuck there. And, you know, so it's, you know, it's at least believable. It's not like, you know, well, we need a character that's irritating or something. You know,
well, I mean,
like,
her superpower is controlling ghosts, right? And if that's the only tool you have, then well, guess what's going to happen?
Yeah, exactly.
And I do like how they just kept around the servants and stuff. And, you know, well, they do explain where, you know, it's like she was trying her best to kind of raise these babies and she was just a 6-year-old right at the time or something like that. So it's like not like she was very well, you know, developed herself to be able to care for infants, but
And I thought that one of the clever things that they had was that Minya had raised their childhood nurse, and you know, she was very attentive, and it, you know, and all the other girls had, you know, all of the other people up there, you know, were really comfortable with her. But she, of course, was in control of the nurse, and so could make them get betrayed at the drop of a hat.
Yeah, it's sort of like a Minya by proxy.
Exactly.
Which is, right. You know, it's the same actor in multiple bodies kind of thing.
Right. And also that's the particular shade of hell that we're getting at the end where, okay, yes, Sarai is brought back, but is brought back by Minya and therefore is basically being held hostage by Minya. And so like in Laszlo's big triumphant moment, there's a huge, oh crap going on.
Right. Where it's like, you better do what I say and I'm going to use you at, you know, to still get revenge against everybody here. I thought the concept, you know, I don't know that I could come up with a better name than Weep. I guess it was supposed to be descriptive, but I thought it was an interesting concept to kind of be like, okay, and this goddess's powers was, you know, she ate the name, basically. She could eat information and just, it removes itself from the universe everywhere.
Right. Wasn't her name something like Leith? I mean, it was...
I don't remember who it was, but mm-hmm. They mentioned that at some point, and that was kind of like one of the things at the very beginning of the book that, you know, maybe in retrospect gives you a hint that Laszlo maybe is connected somehow because he's having these fantasies of being a warrior from, you know, the unknown city or whatever it's called in the hidden city. And like,
right. In this case, it's nobody knows the name.
Yeah. But he called it something like that because he didn't like the word weep. But before
he called it the unseen city.
Yeah, unseen city. And before the name is gone, he's like, you know, playing, you know, warrior out in the orchard or something. And then suddenly in the middle of it, it's like, boom, the name disappears from his head and he kind of freaks out.
Right.
And then later on finds out, yes, it's actually gone from everywhere. All the books, suddenly the name has changed and a couple people seem to realize it, but most people just kind of, you know, say, that was always that way, you know.
Yes. Okay. And we do have here as a discussion point, that moment when you realize it's YA after missing it for most of the book.
Yeah, I'll say that because I was, you know, like I said, I enjoyed the book, but you're kind of going along and all of a sudden you're like, this heavy petty scene seems to be going on a long time. and it doesn't really progress into anything more either. And then you're like, oh, I get it now.
Well, I looked at the rest of the author's bibliography and I went, oh, now I understand.
I mean, it's listed as that.
Right. I usually go kind of out of my way to not know anything about the book when I read it. So it's not kind of colored by like, oh, this happens, you know, on the back of the book. So now you know the ending, you know, which happens half the time, right? Like,
I mean, it is sort of amusing that I thought of this as sort of this, you know, really steamy book. And then when I thought about what we actually knew that these two had done, he kissed her on the shoulder one time.
Ooh. In his dream.
In his dream.
The scandal.
Yeah. Right. Exactly. He only ever touched her when she was dead. So well, that could be creepy in a different way.
Gotta leave that one.
Well, I mean, the vast majority of their relationship, you know, is developed in the dream.
I mean, they basically never actually met.
Yeah. Well, they met, but...
Right, you're in right. dreams.
You were right, yeah.
And or one of them was dead. Usually we call that not meeting, but rules are different here.
M-E-A-T?
Leaving that one.
Good.
Okay.
This so, non-meat space meeting.
Moving on with certain trepidation to the usual questions. Was there tea? Oh, hell yeah. And actually, it gets bonus points for making a distinction between tea and herbal infusions and preferring tea. I like this person.
Yes.
Let's see.
I knew there was a reason this book had a strike against it.
Let's see. What character do you want to be and or who would you be? Our usually bizarrely circumscribed question. Yes, I would choose to be Calixte the Thief. She seems to be pretty cool. She's kind of a minor character, but what the hell?
Yeah, I also selected a fairly minor character as well, which is Ruby, the, I don't want to call her fire goddess, but apparently she shoots fire out of her fingers.
Yes.
I don't know why, but that sounds like a lot of fun. It's way better than shooting things like peanut butter.
Peanut butter fingers.
Shooting peanut butter out of your fingers would have a lot of uses.
Right. All those people who are allergic to peanuts fear me.
Oh, yeah. I was just thinking it would be really easy to make sandwiches.
Yes.
Just wrap your brain around the words projectile peanut butter.
That's not too difficult.
Would you like some peanut butter?
Not right now.
Yes, not really right
now. Open up.
Kevin, any favorites or can we move on?
It's hard to pick when you can pick from special powers, but the dream one sounds kind of cool. I guess you wouldn't have to give other people nightmares. You could just, you know, visit. It would be like lots of holodecks, right?
Okay, so I guess new section. How would we abuse the power of giving people controlled dreams?
Although the plant growing one sounds like it would be cool too.
Sure.
So somehow I get the feeling that every time I have a dream that has Kevin in it, he's just sort of secretly, you know.
Do you have dreams with Kevin in them a lot?
I've had dreams with Kevin in them where he's played some sort of very minor part.
It's like, look, it's a 6502 assembler.
Yeah,
no, then it runs on a 6502. Oh,
if,
you're right.
If that happens, then, you know, if Kevin is talking about 6502 assembler, then one of two things that's happening. One, you're in Kevin's dream. Two, you're actually awake, and it just seems like a dream because why would this be happening?
Oh, God, kill me now.
You've dropped into the source code of the universe, and that's how everything really runs.
Everything's written in 6502.
Kevin's been God this whole time. It explains so much.
Call -151, baby.
Well, that's a joke that's going over really well with the Apple II enthusiasts in the audience.
Yes. Then we have favorite scenes.
Okay, yes, favorite scenes.
I guess one of my favorite bits was towards the beginning where Laszlo sort of like goes down into the bowels of the library into like the old dusty like story area that nobody else goes, and they find him after I don't know how long down there, and the librarian basically says, oh yes, you know, when the library, you know, catches a young boy, we let it keep it, and that's how he becomes a librarian.
Yeah, I did like his mentor there. In fact, my favorite scene was sort of when he was dreaming of Sarai, but he didn't know that that she was Sarai, and then Sarai shows up and like this holodeck version of her is, you know, simpering along with us.
Oh, right.
And I mean, you know, it wasn't anything too bad. It was just, you know, he was having this weird conversation about, oh, you know, they kicked me out of heaven because I lost the moon. Oh, well, let's go to the moon store and buy one.
Right. I mean, it just, and she couldn't decide, so she bought all of them on as like a charm bracelet with real moons on her wrist. And
I mean, it was still more coherent than most of my dreams because it had more unity of space and time than I tend to be able to manage. But still, it had sort of this nice dreamlike off-kilter quality that we didn't have in some of the more deliberate dreams later on. But that was called out. I mean, that wasn't sort of...
Right.
Normally, dreams are just really stupidly handled, and I thought that this was very well handled.
Yeah, with the weird logic. And now that you mention it, it does remind me of, you know, Geordi's holodeck experience.
Yes, there was that scene where the real version of a person comes in and it's just like,
she's like, what?
He's like, it didn't happen like you think it did. It's not as creepy as you might think it is.
Yes,
but it's worse.
It's worse in some ways. It was a deep emotional connection with
photons
with this holodeck character that basically could only point at things.
Right. Like, anyway. Whenever you're touching these nacelles, you're touching me.
Anyway, moving on. I was trying to avoid that.
Ew, I feel kind of squicked out. So my favorite scene also occurred in the library, but it probably wasn't that good for Laszlo.
No.
I do definitely think it was a learning moment for him. It's the scene where Thion basically, you know, comes to him after Laszlo's given him the book of how to, you know, create the Azoth so he could do his transmutation. And he says, if you tell anyone about, you know, what happened, you know, I'm going to basically kill you because I'm going to make you, you know, what is it? The death promise or something.
Something like
that. It's
like,
if you break this promise, you'll die. And he's like, he makes him do it just through, you know, sort of force of will. It sort of seems like that classical bully moment that, you know, a lot of kids have in their lives where it's like, it's this completely irrational situation, you know, and you don't have to technically do it.
Right.
But just the, you know, the fact that it happens and you end up capitulating in some way, I don't know. It felt very real to me.
Yeah. The other thing that I liked about it, and I mentioned this before, is Laszlo doesn't go into this thinking he's going to be rewarded. He doesn't think that Thion is going to be his friend or even appreciate it. He doesn't expect even to be thanked. He doesn't expect to actually be punished for it.
Yeah. I don't even know what to say about that. I mean,
I actually thought it was sort of refreshingly realistic. I always like it when even a relatively innocent main character has a sort of sense of reality. So I don't have to be sitting there thinking, oh, I hate you, you know, for being so stupid.
Right.
And then they don't make Nero this completely unsympathetic character, because they show the strain that he's under, the fact that, you know, he has this really weird existence where he is at the top of everything and has to be better than everyone because he is sort of wrapped up in his own story. And I think that's probably, you know, this whole theme you could get into where everybody has their own dream, their own sort of like sub story, sub universe that they're going along in.
Right. I mean, it could have been very easy for Laszlo to fall into the sort of genre of becoming like the universe's punching bag, right?
Right.
And he doesn't, you know, because in the end he becomes a god.
But I like the fact that he was, even before then, not a super punching bag. He had friends, you know, he made friends on the trip over there. He was, you know, relatively witty. The whole bit actually where he was describing the extremely low probability that, you know, he was just saying, yeah, okay, here's the crazy story that that I think might happen. And it's just, you know, he's telling a story to amuse Calixte.
Yeah.
And other people are laughing at him and he's just sort of saying, you know, I never believed this.
Right. I'm just a librarian. You know, I have this, you know, funny recurring dream. And
right. This is just my idea. I mean, and it turns out mostly to be true, if not entirely.
So in parallel, it's like I'm a software engineer and I have this recurring dream of
two men invading your house and asking you about books,
recording podcasts.
All right. Well, I think it's time for us to break out of this particular shared dream and re-enter the cold gray reality we called life.
Yeah.
And it's going to be fun.
We're going to weep.
We're going to weep. Yes, I've forgotten its name. All right. Until next time, we have been Sci-Fi.
Sci-Fi.
Sci-Fi.